60,000 nanomachines at work, the task would take many days for results to even begin to flow back to the Vortan's AI. Iliath and her crew waited, and waited, and waited for results. Every day she checked the progress of the sensor sweep and waited for the AI to announce a preliminary result. Every day she was disappointed. Until that day. Commander Iliath, the AI spoke abruptly while she was engaged in studying a report about the ghost ship's latest attack.
Yes.
Preliminary results are now available. Pushing the report to the back of her mind, she ordered her couch to bring her upright.
How preliminary?
The sensor machines have completed scanning only 12% of the target zone. However, I have 79% confidence that scans of the remaining area will not conflict with the current results. Iliath had already downloaded the file and was sorting through it. It was a veritable mountain of data.
Are there any immediate surprises?
Yes. Sensors have detected evidence of a Bosphorok ship, but also many other ships from multiple species. That is surprising, given the remote location of the battle.
Show me,
she ordered, irritation creeping into her voice.
Yes, Commander. Before I do that, might I be permitted to tell you the most surprising result so far?
Permission granted.
The machine was assuming too much familiarity. That would require an adjustment to its programming.
What is it?
While it is not unexpected to find biological markers at the site of a battle, one of the markers cannot be explained.
What did you find?
Human DNA. After the devastating and shocking attack that blew two of their warships to dust, the Maxulks appeared to have left the research base on Capradru alone, other than a half-dozen ships jumping in to recon the area within a week of the battle. When those recon ships jumped away and the research base was left alone for 43 days, some of the inhabitants began to dare hope they would survive unscathed. The Maxulks had bigger problems to worry about, or they had reached a deal with the Bosphorok government, or the ghost ship was so powerful it had forced the Maxulks to surrender. The residents of the research base simply did not know what was going on in the wider galaxy. They had no ship capable of faster-than-light travel, and their navy sent no ships to communicate with them, so they could only wait fearfully, watching the sky for telltale gamma-ray bursts. If the burst was barely detectable, that would be the death sentence of a Maxulk ship arriving. A stronger burst would hopefully be a friendly ship coming to defend the base, or pull the entire population off the desolate planet and take them away to safety. When the days dragged on with no sign of either impending destruction or salvation, the administrator began to lose control of his team as baseless rumors began to spread. People in desperate need of hope heard what they wanted to hear, and the administrator had no hope to offer. The rumors offered comfort. The ghost ship that blew up the two destroyers was so powerful the Maxulks dared not attack any planet under the ghost ship's protection. The ghost ship was striking widely across Maxulk's territory, forcing the patrons of the Bosphorok to pull their own warships back to defensive positions. No, the ghost ship was still lurking near Capradru, ready to pounce on any ships that dared attack the defenseless world. No, the ghost ship had already forced the Maxulks to negotiate a ceasefire with the Bosphorok. All the rumors had one thing in common. The administrator had received communications from outside and was concealing the truth. He did not want the people to know the truth, so he could rule them by fear. On the 44th day, as measured by the rotation of the Bosphorok homeworld, the agitators had enough of waiting. Their leader urged his followers to march on the offices of the administrator and force the man out. As the base was a science station, the administrator had not been provided with any weapons, and the two-person military security team decided to stay out of civilian disputes. In the administrator's records, the agitators found no hint of communications from the outside, but their leader assured them that only meant the dastardly former occupant of the office had erased the evidence. "Do not worry," their new leader told the unhappy crowd, "he would get to the truth." To his trusted inner circle, he told them to stall while he ransacked the office for valuables. A bottle of 30-year-old Shays was the only worthwhile item he found. So he got some glasses and enjoyed the fiery liquid with his friends.
The crowd outside would wait while he thought of what evidence to fake. The first hint of approaching trouble was an early warning satellite going offline, which raided the defense AI to alert the administrator's office, where three people were sleeping off the effects of consuming an entire bottle of vintage Shays. Thus, the initial warning was ignored. The next sign of trouble was a brief but odd sensor reading, captured by a satellite in low orbit. There was a moment of terrified excitement by the defense AI when the high-energy sensor reading was confused for a gamma-ray burst. Then, when the reading was evaluated and corrected, it too was consigned to the status report. The scientists who could have confirmed or disputed the sensor reading were mostly gathered outside the administrator's office, blissfully unaware of any alert. Thus, when the 20-meter-wide asteroid impacted the planet's surface directly above the buried research base, moving at 31% of light speed, it was a complete surprise. The asteroid had dropped its stealth field only 2 seconds before it contacted the atmosphere, leaving no time for base personnel to react to the AI's frantic alert. The only good news was that someone got to enjoy an excellent bottle of vintage Shays before the bottle and the planet's crust in that area were obliterated. Our happy time was a busy and satisfying 2 months. For me, it was especially happy, because Margaret Adams was making slow and steady progress. She did not do anything spectacular. That was the point. Yes, she had bad days, discouraging days. Of course, her progress was slower than she wanted, and exactly on the schedule Skippy recommended. By the end of 3 weeks after she woke from the coma, she was able to speak normally, if a bit slower than she had before, and with a stutter she hated. Skippy assured her and me that her speaking ability would make a full recovery. He gradually deactivated the nanoprobes in her brain, as her own neurons regrew and made new connections. Though I knew the little machines were helping her make faster progress, it was still creepy to think of alien bots crawling around inside her head. I was not the only person who did not like the idea of nanobots artificially enhancing the natural abilities Adams had. The good faith decision I made for her had consequences, and they weren't all good. Like I said, she had good days and bad days. On bad days, she stumbled while walking and fell off the exercise bike, and her clumsy fingers shook when trying to bring a spoon to her mouth, and she got so frustrated when trying to talk that she burst into tears. That was really bad, because when she was crying, she tended to stutter and babble, which made it even more difficult for her to talk. Sims came rushing into my office unannounced one day.
"Sir, you need to go to—"
Skippy's voice interrupted. "Hey, Joe, I—" "Not now, Skippy. Sims, what is it?" She looked at the ceiling before answering.
"Skippy and I may be talking about the same thing. Is it Adams?"
"It is," Skippy confirmed. "Oh, shit." I shot up from my chair. The worst things I could imagine raced through my mind in vivid detail. Why is my brain so lightning fast to picture bad things and so painfully slow when I needed it to do something useful? "What happened?" Sims spoke first.
"I was helping her with therapy. Cognitive stuff, memorization games, that sort of—"
Seeing my impatience with details, she skipped to the end.
"She's having a bad day. A really bad day. She is pissed at you, sir, for putting nanomachines in her head. She is worried that all of the progress she has made is artificial, and it's not her making the progress. That you've turned her into some sort of cyborg."
"Shit." I stared at the floor. I'd been dreading that conversation. "She is wrong about that," Skippy assured us. "But Joe, we have a problem. Margaret wants me to deactivate and remove all the nanobots inside her." "Whoa. Whoa indeed, Joe. Such an abrupt action could be very harmful. It might kill her."
"I tried talking to her," Sims added. "Reason with her. Told her she is just having a bad day. She is adamant. She wants them out of her. She wants to be Margaret again, not some—" "She said you have made her into a monster. She would rather be dead."
I was torn between wanting to race to the medical bay that was set aside for post-recovery therapy and wanting to take a minute to think first. Confronting her without a plan for what I would say, without having a damn good argument against ripping the nanobots out of her body, would do nothing but piss her off. My feet wanted to move now. My brain made my restless feet stay planted on the deck of my office.
Skippy, stall her, however you can. Tell her some bullshit like you have to prep the extraction machines first.
I have already stalled her, Joe. Margaret demanded that it is her right to make medical decisions for herself. My reply was that as she is partly reliant on alien machines to think for her, she is not legally competent, and you still have power of attorney for her.
I do?
Ugh. No. Try to keep up, please. Joe, I gave her whatever line of bullshit I could think of. Legally, it's kind of in a schmaby-level gray area. Technically, she has not completed therapy, and she is clearly still impaired. Regardless of the legal rules you monkeys wrote for yourselves, I will not do anything to harm Margaret. Except, he choked up. If she begs me as her friend. Joe, I am in a very tough spot here, he pleaded. You gotta help me. Help her. Damn it, I muttered to myself. I am the last person she wants to see right now. Sims bobbed her head up and down once. That's why you need to go talk with her. I knew she was right. That didn't make it any easier. Will you? That time, her head shook side to side. This is all you, sir. When I reached the therapy bay, Adams was sitting on the deck trying to pull a sneaker on her right foot. Her hands shook, and her foot kept missing the opening. When she saw me, I held up my hands without saying anything. She turned away from me and angrily threw the shoe across the compartment, except she missed. It bounced off the table opposite her and flopped back at her feet. She buried her face in her hands and her whole body shook. What the hell was I supposed to say? What could I say? There wasn't anything about this situation in my office of training manuals. Not knowing what to do, I fell back on trying to be a decent human being. That is usually a good idea. I walked softly across the deck and sat down on the floor next to her. Gunny, can we talk? Without looking at me, face still covered by her hands, she spoke with vehemence. I want these alien things out of my head. Skippy says they are helping you. Adams, you have made a lot of progress. The bots in my head have made a lot of progress. She glanced at me, angrily wiping tears away from her face with the sleeves of her shirt. I knew better than to offer a towel from the bin next to me. If she wanted a towel or anything else, she would ask for one. Or she would get it herself. This isn't me. She tapped her forehead. Gunny, you had a bad day, that's all. She reached down to pick up the sneaker. Three times she missed. As I watched, she concentrated hard on making her hand slowly slide across the floor to the shoe, then laboriously walked her fingers up to hook around a lace. When she lifted the shoe, her hand trembled. Skippy has been deactivating the bot slowly. As the bots go offline, I have. She glared at me. What you call bad days? They are bad because the bots are no longer doing the work for me. I am not getting any better. Her whole body shuddered. She dropped the shoe and slumped back against the bulkhead, racked with sobs. The shaking was likely worse because of her condition, not that it mattered. It was time for me to put aside rank structure and military protocol and just be a decent human being. So I leaned over and put one arm around her. I didn't say anything. She didn't say anything. Whether it was because she shook or because she wanted to, she pressed her shoulder against me. For her, it was one of the lowest moments of her life. For me, it is a memory I will always cherish. Skippy could not keep his stupid mouth shut. Damn it, I had such a nice speech planned in my head. A tender moment, just me and Margaret Adams. Before I could say anything, Skippy opened his big stupid mouth. That is not true, Margaret, he announced cheerily. While it is true that I am slowly deactivating the nanoprobes, their loss is not causing your bad days. Quite the opposite, in fact. I deactivate bots because they are no longer needed, as your own neural circuitry is able to handle the tasks. Then why? She pushed away from me, and just like that, the special moment was gone.
She lifted the sneaker and held it up with effort. The shoe wobbled slightly as she cradled it in both hands.
"Was I able to put my damned shoes on yesterday, and I can't do it today? I've been..."
She wiped away a tear as I pointedly looked straight ahead.
"Putting my own shoes on since I was a toddler."
"Yes." Skippy's voice dripped with impatient, clueless condescension. "You did have a good day yesterday. That is why I was able to deactivate another set of nanoprobes. But the loss of that set has nothing to do with the motor control difficulties you are experiencing today. You would be experiencing even better control than you did yesterday if I wasn't using other nanoprobes to interfere with the natural wiring in your head."
"You're doing what?" Adam sputtered, while I only opened my mouth, stunned.
Skippy replied in his patiently explaining things to Monkey's tone.
"I am using..." It was my turn for outrage. "We know what you are doing, for God's sake. Why?"
The heights of Skippy's arrogance was matched only by his cluelessness.
"To accelerate her recovery, duh! By interfering with the signals between neurons, I am forcing those neurons to adapt, to grow stronger, to make new connections. If you monkeys knew anything about how biological brains truly work, you would understand."
"You are making me..." She held up the shoe with one hand, and it shook.
"More clumsy? To help me?"
"Yes!" "Ah!" he sighed. "Try this. I just turned off the interference temporarily." The shoe she was holding no longer shook. Adams carefully pushed back against the bulkhead and stood up. As a test, she used one hand to steady herself while her other hand pulled the shoe on. She still shook a bit, but her voice still had a quivering quality to it, but she no longer stuttered.
"I can talk."
She pronounced each word slowly, carefully.
"Peter Piper picked a peck of..."
She took a breath.
"Pickled peppers. Oh,"
she gasped.
"I didn't stutter."
"No, you did not," Skippy gloated. "I can turn off the interference, but it will delay your therapy, your progress to complete recovery, by several weeks, possibly a month. Your brain is a powerful and complex but fragile organ."
"I can't. Why didn't you tell me?"
"Because knowing might change the way you respond to therapy. Besides, you thrive on challenges, right?" Margaret Adams turned to me, rage glowing in her eyes. It was good that her rage wasn't directed at me. Tapping my earlobe activated the Z-phone earpiece.
"Bridge, this is Bishop,"
Reed answered.
"Bridge here."
She sounded distracted, in addition to acting as the duty officer, she was probably working with a group of trainees. "Reed, eject escape pod 23 Alpha. That was the designation for Skippy's bodacious new man cave aboard Valkyrie. "Once it gets to a safe distance, hit it with every weapon we've got."
"Hey!" Skippy shouted.
Our chief pilot was shocked.
"Say that again, please?"
She was probably flashing back to when UNEF tried to eject Skippy's man cave from the Flying Dutchman. Adams laughed. She not only laughed, she actually leaned toward me so her head rested on my shoulder for a glorious, lingering moment.
"Thank you for the gesture, sir, but..."
"Reed," I ordered, with a wink to Adams. "Belay that. Ignore what I said."
"I'm not sure I understood what you said."
Reed was incredulous.
"Is that all, sir?"
"That's all." I cut the connection.
"What did I do?" Skippy screeched. "Damn it! I get in trouble no matter what I do!"
Ignoring the beer can, I addressed my remark to Adams.
"Gunny, it seems to me you have a choice. Ask Skippy to cancel the interference and possibly delay your recovery. Or keep going as you have and return to duty sooner."
Her eyes narrowed, like she didn't believe what I said. Like she thought I was just giving her a line of bullshit that was false hope. With her barely able to walk, I could understand why she thought the prospect of returning to a star team was an impossible dream.
"Return to duty?
Gunny, there is a whole galaxy full of aliens out there who desperately need to get their asses kicked. I can't do it all by myself."
"Yes, sir."
She stood at attention. The only reason I could see she shook a bit was because I was looking for the signs. Taking a deep breath, she asked,
Skippy?
Yes?
I'm still pissed at you, she warned him.
Skippy sighed. It was the sigh of guys everywhere who know they can't win an argument against a woman.
Is there a compromise? Can you turn on the interference when I'm engaged in therapy, but not when I'm getting dressed or eating in the galley?
I could do that. He slipped back into his mad Dr. Skippy persona. It would be a terrible idea, but I could do that. Margaret, when you are doing things that require fine motor control, like buttoning a blouse or using a spoon to eat soup, everyday things like that, your brain learns. It gets embedded into what you call muscle memory. That happens best when you're not thinking about what you're doing. Therapy is useful, but in therapy, you are consciously moving every muscle. Spilling a little soup is a small price to pay for completing your recovery quickly. But that's just my opinion, he sniffed.
I will think about it, she frowned. It makes that much of a difference?
I wouldn't do it if it wasn't important. Skippy's usual snarky tone was gone. Margaret, I hate seeing you shake and be frustrated. He sounded on the verge of tears.
I will do whatever you wish.
If that's okay with you, Joe.
Me?
Yes. You have her power of attorney, remember? Duh!
Oh, yeah.
Shit, I should have taken care of that issue right away. Skippy, I am stating for the record that Gunnery Sergeant Adams is fully competent to make medical decisions for herself. Make a note of that. Where he would make that note, I had no clue. As the ship's captain, that is probably something I should know. I made a note to ask Sims about it.
Thank you, sir, Adams said with relief.
Don't thank me, Gunny. What you can do is check with your commanding officer before you make rash decisions that affect the very important team asset. Understood?
That's what I am?
She crossed her arms and tilted her head at me.
An important asset?
Part of me wanted to make a joke about her assets. Ah, the little boy in me was dying to make that joke. I was proud of myself for not doing that. Officially, yes.
Officially.
She sounded disappointed. Other than that, this whole conversation never happened, if that's okay with you.
That would be best, yes.
Skippy, she sighed as she sat on the padded table that was used for therapy.
You can turn the interface back on. But from now on, you tell me everything you are doing. Is that clear?
Crystal clear, he grumbled. Jeez, who knew monkeys would be so sensitive about the mush in their skulls? Skippy, I can still eject your escape pod, I warned him. All right, I get the message.
Then we're all good.
And? I couldn't read the way Adams was looking at me. What is it, Gunny?
I'm trying to decide if I still hate you, sir.
Well, if you're not sure about it, that's good news. How about if we both agree to hate Skippy and go from there?
That's good.
She gave me the side eye.
I still feel like punching you.
Permission granted, Gunnery Sergeant. She expertly arched an eyebrow. There was no problem with her motor function in that area.
For real, sir?
Adams, there are a lot of beings in this galaxy who want to punch me. Most of them are human.
That's only because the aliens don't know you are alive.
True enough, I admitted. It doesn't matter anyway. Gunny, your hands are shaking so bad you couldn't hit. She popped me right in the face, hard. I had a black eye for a week. I call that progress. Chapter 12. In half of our attacks during our wonderful 2 months of happy time, we weren't able to destroy all the enemy ships that we targeted, but that's okay. We didn't need a clean sweep on every attack, while we did need to limit our risk. That risk increased every day as the Maxalts adjusted to the threat of our ghost ship. They stopped sending any warships out alone. Usually, warships traveled in formations of three or more.
Ships in formation were also spread out, which reduced the ability of ships to support each other, but also meant not all ships in a formation would be trapped in our powerful dampen field. That was smart. The enemy also changed tactics so that when our ghost ship appeared without warning, any ships not in our damping field immediately performed a short emergency jump. From a distance of 10 or more light seconds, they were safely beyond range of our damping field, but able to observe the action and decide how to react. If everything went according to plan, by the time the escort ship had decided how to respond and coordinated their actions, we had already hammered our target ship to space dust and jumped away to raid again. Our targets were no larger than a heavy cruiser. We avoided tangling with capital ships. Twice we hit destroyer squadrons. The first time we did that was not an unqualified success. We jumped away after blowing up one destroyer and likely damaging two others. It was good enough, and with the other destroyers hovering around us like bees and launching every missile they had, I kinda lost my nerve, so we jumped away. That was a lesson learned. We had trained to fight against standard destroyer squadron tactics, but the Maxalks had learned from our attacks and adapted. The second time we targeted a destroyer squadron was our 12th attack overall. It was a bold move, because that squadron had just escorted a group of cruisers and heavy cruisers to a shipyard, then headed back out. We hit them at the edge of that well-defended star system where the squadron was waiting for a star carrier. Because they were expecting a rendezvous, three of the ships were bunched up in close formation, and we achieved complete surprise. We blew up those three destroyers before the other four could jump in to surround us. Those four brave ships, knowing they might be doomed, jumped into an area of space we had just departed. Whether their crews were disappointed or relieved to find we had already left, we did not know. Two of those destroyers attempted to follow us, with one of the little ships tracking us through two jumps before Valkyrie escaped by performing an extra long jump the destroyer could not match. Sims, annoyed at the pursuit, suggested we set a trap, but I vetoed that idea. We had accomplished our mission and did not need to take on additional risk for one small ship. For all we knew, that destroyer was trying to locate us so a large task group from the shipyard could join the chase, and we'd had enough fun for the day. On my order, we performed several jumps to get clear of the area and rendezvoused with the Dutchman. After the 12th attack, the crew was pumped, but a bit weary of the constant cycle of analysis, planning, training, attack, evaluate. Skippy wanted me to call for a stand down so our two ships could make repairs and some adjustments he wanted to tinker with. That made sense to me, and I was about to order a break in operations, but then something happened that had nothing to do with the Maxalts, or saving Earth, or any nonsense like that. What happened? As I walked into our gym and saw Margaret Adams in the section we used for yoga, aerobics, and other exercise classes. She had her back to me and was posed on one foot, her other leg straight out behind her, arms stretched forward. It was a yoga pose that had an official name in Yogaland, though I had no idea what it was. I called that pose the Big Fig Newton. Okay, I'd better explain that. On Thanksgiving, my Uncle Edgar would come to our house with wife number one, or two, or his girlfriend of the moment. He raided my father's liquor cabinet for the good scotch, knowing to push aside the decoy bottles of cheap Canadian whiskey in the front. After the meal, a slice of pie at the table and a second slice on the couch while watching football, he went back into the kitchen for a snack to, as he said it, fill in the corners of his stomach. Because my mother put out a tray of Fig Newton cookies so we could claim to have eaten something healthy that day, Uncle Edgar inevitably ate a cookie while contorting himself on one foot, shouting, "I'm the Big Fig Newton!" Also inevitably, he fell over as a result of drinking too much scotch. By the time I was 7 years old, I learned to move the tray of cookies onto the little table by the front door so Uncle Edgar did not fall in the dining room or knock over the TV. Anyway, Big Fig Newton. Look it up on YouTube. Margaret was balancing well, with a noticeable wobble. That wobble could have been due to her leg muscles that had not rebuilt from her enforced idleness. What mattered, the purpose of the exercise, was to test and work on her sense of balance. Seeing her do so well made me smile. I did not even mind that instead of working on balance exercises alone or with a partner like Frey, she was with Grudzian. Why was that a problem? Frey is a woman. Grudzian is a guy. See the problem?
No.
Okay, how about this? Grudzian was being extra helpful by lightly placing a hand along the small of her back, or under her thighs. Once while I stood there, he put a hand on her breastbone when she started to topple over. At least his hand had better not have touched any other part of her chest. They were talking softly, smiling. She was looking away from me, and he was looking at her. When she broke the pose, she pumped a fist and leapt in the air, coming down to topple toward him. He held onto her shoulders to steady her, and they laughed. It was that easy laughter of people who knew each other well, people who were not afraid of appearing vulnerable in front of the other. They embraced, and she gave him a little kiss on the cheek. When she bent down to pick up a towel, I spun and pretended I had just come in and was headed toward the treadmills. "Colonel Bishop," she called out, her eyes gleaming bright. "Gunny," I forced a smile. "Aerobics?" "No, balance exercises. Watch this." Holding the towel between her hands in a prayer gesture, she stood on one foot, tilting her head back. She held the pose for a few seconds before she had to lower the other foot.
"Making progress."
"You are." I clapped my hands twice. "Keep up the good work."
"We will,"
Grudzian answered at the same time she did. The two of them looked at each other, laughing.
"We will, sir," Grudzian added.
I flashed a thumbs up in their direction before turning away. If I'd tried to say something, my voice might have cracked. On the treadmill, I had no enthusiasm for the workout. There was no excuse, and I knew it, so I pushed myself. It sucked. Maybe I had been given an answer. Margaret either did not remember our intimate heart-to-heart talk, or she did remember, and she was uncomfortable about it. If that was the case, there were two more possibilities. She was embarrassed by being so vulnerable with me, and she regretted leading me on, because she knew we could never be together. Or she regretted what she said because she did not have feelings for me. What she said could have been the nanobots talking. If I knew the second possibility was true, I was not going to push the issue, not going to further make her uncomfortable around me. Since our fateful talk, she had not called me Joe again, so maybe I had an answer about that. As you might have heard, my superhero identity is Stubborn Man. Yes, I am also No Patience Man. That's more of a side job. I am also not shy. If there was still a possibility that there could be something between me and Margaret, I was going to fight for her. Fight for us. No way was I just going to stand by and let her slip away. The UN's main complaint about me is that I too often act without thinking through the full consequences of my actions, but I act. Standing by is not me. No, I was not going to throw Justin Grudzian out an airlock and claim it was a training accident. Okay, maybe I daydreamed about doing that, so sue me. What I was going to do was remind Margaret what a strong, confident, and decisive leader I am, even if that means doing something rash and stupid. So it was kind of a perfect storm. A tempting target falling into our laps, right when I needed a big win. "Skippy," I called the beer can when I walked into my office. "I agree that we need a stand down." "Oh, goody. I was afraid you were going to suggest something stupid, like a stand down after we hit another target. I want to hit something big. I thought we were not doing anything stupid." "This isn't stupid, it's bold. There's a difference." "Like what?" "Like this is our job. My job. I'm a soldier. Delivering ordnance on target is what we do, you know?" "I don't have a problem with that. The problem is eventually you will push your luck too far and get us all into serious trouble." "Skippy, we have learned a lot in a short time. We have learned how to operate this new ship, which tactics are best in each situation. We've learned how the enemy responds to various types of attacks. The enemy has adjusted their tactics, and we have learned from that also. We've gotten better at this. We are kicking ass out here. For now, yes, don't get cocky, Flyboy. Sooner or later, the kitties will figure out your pattern and, whoa! No one can predict when we're going to hit next. I don't have a pattern. Joe, yes, you do. How?" I was pissed at him. Not for telling me the truth, but for gloating about it.
He knew something I didn't know, and he absolutely loved telling me what a dim-witted monkey I am. Throwing up my hands, I glared at him. We picked targets at random. We deliberately skipped some very tempting targets and attacked elsewhere so we wouldn't have a pattern the enemy could detect. You think you did that, Joe? You're wrong. All of our attacks have been against isolated ships that have less firepower than Valkyrie. Also, to sell the story that our attacks are retaliation for Maxalt's strikes against the Bosphorok, we have selected targets that conducted such strikes, or were planning to. That limits the search criteria. Yeah, we did that at first, then we switched tactics. We hit any Maxalt ship that was a good target, regardless of what it did or was planning to do. You added a whole rant to your manifesto about how we were taking the fight to the heart of the enemy, that sort of bullshit. Doesn't matter. He shook his head stubbornly. You still have an identifiable pattern. It's not your fault, Joe. You can't help it. Your organic brain has a set way of thinking, of creating new ideas. You can play around with it a bit, but overall, you have a style that is identifiable as you. It's like songwriters. They all have a style that is uniquely theirs, even if they write in multiple genres. Oh, well, sure, Skippy, I understand that. It doesn't make sense that the Maxalts could predict my next move just based on data from a few attacks. It's more than that, Joe. I'm pretty sure that somewhere the Kitties have an AI that is being taught to think like you, make decisions the way you do. They will program in data from the first 6 attacks and run scenarios through the AI until it successfully predicts the 7th attack. Then they'll keep going, seeing if the AI would have predicted the 8th attack, and so on. The Kitties will continue refining their predictive model until it is able to anticipate your next move. Holy shit. They can do that? Hell, Joe. To a limited extent, even you monkeys are able to do that. That's a scary thought. That isn't the most frightening thing about this, Joe. Then what is? Some poor AI out there, he sobbed, is being taught to think like you. I can't imagine the suffering. Admiral Erkan of the Maxalt's Hegemony's 14th Fleet was the last to arrive at the hastily assembled conference of senior commanders. The area patrolled by the 14th Fleet had so far not been targeted by the ghost ship that was marauding across the space lanes, but Erkan knew it was only a matter of time before one of his ships fell victim to the unstoppable scourge. To attend the meeting, he had taken the precaution of flying aboard a battleship attached to a star carrier that was transporting 2 heavy cruisers. For a senior admiral of the Hegemony to fear for his own safety was a situation that could not be tolerated. After the initial mundane greetings, the meeting began with statements of useless outrage by everyone present. An alert had just been received of a 10th attack by the ghost ship, and given how slowly information had to travel by relay stations, more attacks could already have happened. So when it was Erkan's turn to assure his colleagues how outraged he was, he instead got straight to the point.
We can't wait for the AIs of Fleet Intelligence Division to analyze the ghost ship's pattern of behavior. We need to act now.
Erkan, we are taking action, Admiral Reichert snapped impatiently.
His own 8th Fleet had been a favorite target of the ghost ship, having been victimized 4 times, including the most recent attack.
We are...
Erkan interrupted before Reichert could work himself up to a lengthy rant.
How do you catch a predator?
Reichert snarled at having his speech cut off in mid-rant, but the woman seated to Erkan's left spoke first.
Poisoned bait?
Admiral Zeverant mused, nodding to her colleague.
Bait,
Erkan smiled, exposing his fangs.
Allure. The enemy has the initiative. We have been reactive. It is time to go on the offensive.
Reichert slapped a hand on the table, his claws making a loud click on the hard surface.
My forces have been on offense ever since...
No, Zeverant said coolly. We have been acting against our clients, against their research facilities. Those actions have been punishment, not offense. Our strikes against the Bosphorok have had no effect on the ghost ship. They only serve to turn our clients further against us, and to make heroes of the ghost ship's crew. Erkan is correct. We will not stop these attacks by flailing around aimlessly.
We do not know where the ghost ship will attack next.
We can reduce their area of operation, Reichert insisted, if we implement my plan for a progressive blockade.
Grumbles and groans were heard around the room in response. Ever since the first attack on the Eighth Fleet, Reichert had been relentlessly urging a blockade of wormholes in a bubble of space around the ghost ship's latest area of operation, which his colleagues knew meant he wanted their ships to be placed under his command in his area of control.
Reichert, we have discussed this. A blockade is impractical. Supporting merely a thin blockade of the wormhole to the human planet has stretched our forces. Your Eighth Fleet encompasses an area with 96 wormholes.
We do not need to blockade them all, only the ones surrounding the most recent attack. We could reduce the enemy's options.
He pressed his hands tightly together, claws out.
We squeeze them into a smaller and smaller area. Cut off their support from the treacherous Bosphorak.
We don't have any evidence that ship has been getting any support, Zevran noted. Wherever their base is, it could be outside territory controlled by the Bosphorak.
It could be anywhere.
Reichert leaned forward aggressively.
It is useless to... Esteemed Admiral Reichert, Erkan said with irritation.
Fighting his natural urge to slap the pompous fool, Erkan reminded himself that arguing would accomplish nothing.
We are both proposing different tactics to achieve the same goal. You seek to limit the area where the enemy can operate. I propose that we know where and when the enemy will be by providing a target the ghost ship cannot resist.
When Reichert relaxed his stance slightly, Erkan continued.
I have arranged for a star carrier that is transporting 4 destroyers and 2 light cruisers to schedule a rendezvous with 2 light cruisers. The stated purpose of the flight is to reposition escort vessels so they can accompany merchant convoys.
Zevran immediately thought she understood Erkan's scheme.
You have leaked information about the rendezvous?
Not leaked. That would be too obvious. I assume that somehow the ghost ship has access to our secure communications. Impossible, Reichert scoffed. Not impossible,
Erkan replied in an even tone, seeing no advantage in offending his colleague.
There is no other explanation for how the enemy knows where our ships are. They must be intercepting our message traffic, though none of us wants to think that could be true. We know the ghost ship is a modified Extinction-class battlecruiser, apparently assembled from parts of multiple ships. I would have said it was impossible for anyone to capture one of our warships.
He paused to see the slowly twitching ears around the table.
Yet fleet intelligence has determined that more than one of our ships clearly have been captured. The enemy could be using the interchanges they captured with the ships. That is another reason we must act now,
he added as Reichert was opening his mouth.
As you know, we are replacing our entire stock of interchangers. Soon, the interchangers the enemy are using will be useless, and they will no longer have access to our communications. We therefore must act now, or we will lose the ability to lure the ghost ship to its destruction.
Zevran spoke next.
You assume the enemy knows about your star carrier?
Yes. There is nothing different or special about the orders detailing the flight plans of the star carrier or the 2 light cruisers it will rendezvous with. Nothing in the messages could make the enemy suspicious. Erkan, while I congratulate your initiative,
Reichert emphasized the word to remind his colleagues that the commander of the 14th Fleet had acted without consulting fleet headquarters.
One star carrier and 8 light ships have little chance of capturing a battlecruiser.
Erkan's ears stood up.
I agree, esteemed colleague. That is why the star carrier is actually transporting 4 heavy cruisers and 4 patrol cruisers. The orders to dispatch those ships were carried by trusted officers of my command, with no record of the orders or ship movements transmitted to any relay stations. To avoid alerting the enemy, the ships waiting at the rendezvous are light cruisers, whose captains are unaware they are being used as bait.
Why not battleships? Reichert asked, flexing his claws. He felt a need to point out flaws in Erkan's plan.
Battle groups travel with multiple escort and support vessels, so it is much more difficult for us to conceal the movement of a battleship. Due to their unique combination of firepower, speed, and range, our limited number of battlecruisers are already fully tasked to critical assignments, and pulling even one off the line would be noticed by someone somewhere.
You have already put this plan into motion,
Zevran stated, as it was not a question.
When is the rendezvous?
16 standard days from now, Erkan reported, pleased that no one of the powerful officers around the table had objected. That lack of objections was a mild surprise. He had been prepared for someone to be jealous of being left out of the potential glory. Perhaps they were all so weary of the increasingly strident public outcry for their vaunted fleet to do something that they just wanted the ghost ship attacks to be over. There would be plenty of opportunity to steal some of the credit later. A star carrier with 4 destroyers and 2 light cruisers. That is the bait, Reichert mused. That would be a tempting target for us, but the ghost ship has been timid about selecting targets, he noted, being sure to catch the eyes of his associates. The ghost ship, Erkan replied with confidence, has been growing increasingly bold. If this lure does not work, we can offer softer targets until the ghost ship can't resist.
Very well.
Reichert's mind was calculating how to take advantage if Erkan's plan failed, and how to exploit the situation if the operation succeeded. What do you need from us?
What is the target this time, sir? Smythe asked me.
There was not the usual predatory enthusiasm in his voice, nor in his posture. Usually, when we reviewed battle plans, he was seated at attention or leaning forward on the table with intense concentration. Maybe the ongoing therapy for his legs, plus getting back into a regular fitness routine, had worn him out. That, or after 12 attacks during which the star team were merely observers, while the pilots and bridge crew had all the fun, had dampened his enthusiasm. Many of the stars had been cross-training to stand watches on the bridge, but during attacks, they were suited up in case we found a need for them. To date, we had not found a need to send vulnerable biological beings out of the ship, so the bridge crew experienced excitement and moments of stomach-churning danger, while the stars experienced waiting, boredom, and disappointment. This target is so juicy, we will all need napkins. I tried to lighten the mood. Only Reed cracked a smile, and that quickly faded. Listen, people. I know our op tempo has been demanding for the past 2 months. We need a stand down. The ship, both ships, need a stand down. We'll get one. At the right time. I would not consider another typical strike right now, but this target is too good to pass up. We hit this target hard, and the enemy will be shedding their fur. I smiled. Again, my attempt to lighten the mood fell flat. Think about it this way. We need a pause to refit our ships, refuel, and Skippy wants to make adjustments to Valkyrie again. We'll be out of action for 10 days, maybe 2 weeks. The bad guys have to be hoping our single ship can't support an extended campaign without support. They have to be thinking they can just wait for our ship to wear out. We know their leadership is more worried about the Rindaloo exploiting the situation than they are about one ghost ship. We are hurting them. We are embarrassing them. And still, they can consider us just a cost of doing business. So far, we have confined our attacks to individual ships or small formations of small and vulnerable ships. The kiddies are adjusting their tactics, and soon we will lose the ability to conduct hit-and-run attacks without taking unacceptable risks. But if we hit this target, they will have to reconsider their response. Smythe blinked once, slowly, before repeating his question. He was being tactful, not making a point that I hadn't actually answered the question.
The target. What is it?
A single star carrier, I explained. That is transporting 4 destroyers and 2 light cruisers.
Chapter 13. We wargamed the 13th attack to identify the most likely scenarios, then ran simulations until we were confident we had minimized the risk. The difference in scenarios was not the number of ships we would have to fight, it was the type of ships we had to deal with.
The intel Skippy intercepted assured us we would be facing a single star carrier, so that limited the variety of trouble we could get into. It was unlikely the star carrier would be hauling a battleship, but if we jumped in and discovered a big battle wagon in our sights, we could handle it. Maxulk's battleships were big warships designed for heavy bombardment of planets and defense of vital assets. They were so big they took up all the platforms on one side of a star carrier. They were so massive, only one could be hauled by a carrier. Armed with that information, we knew that if the star carrier had a battleship, it would only have one, and the other ships would be light escorts, such as destroyers. The attack plan in that case was to fire everything we had at the star carrier and escorts, then jump away before we could get tangled up with the capital ship. Skippy thought we could win a stand-up fight with a battleship, but only with a shmaybe level of confidence. The problem was while we fought the big ship, the escorts would be sniping at us, and they were dangerous. You might think our badass battlecruiser had nothing to fear from a destroyer, or even a squadron of destroyers. That might have been true a long time ago. It was not true now. It used to be that small warships like destroyers had only a few small guns. They couldn't shoot far, couldn't shoot more than a few shells at a time, and those lightweight shells couldn't do a lot of damage to a well-armored larger ship like a cruiser. Meanwhile, a cruiser could remain beyond the effective range of a destroyer's puny 5-inch main guns, using its own much heavier guns to pound the destroyer until it was a sinking hulk. The destroyer's thin armor meant it would be disabled or sunk by a single hit from a cruiser's guns. Why am I giving you this history lesson? Because it is history. Ancient history. In the war we were fighting, a destroyer was equipped with the same missiles as a battleship. It didn't matter to us which ship had fired the missile. That warhead could hurt us just as badly. Destroyers also usually had the same maser cannons and rail guns as were installed aboard larger ships, and you could only put so much power through a maser cannon exciter before it burned out. What, then, made a battlecruiser like Valkyrie more powerful in combat than a destroyer? Bigger ships could hit harder because they had more cannons and more missile launch tubes. A small ship like a destroyer typically only carried enough reloads for 2 or 3 salvos before it ran out of missiles, while Valkyrie's magazines could supply each launcher with 8 shots. The most important distinction between an escort vessel like a destroyer and a capital ship like a battlecruiser was its level of protection. Valkyrie's hull had a thick layer of armor with reactive panels underneath to break up incoming plasma streams that could burn clear through the vulnerable interior. Destroyers were clad in armor only thick enough to deflect shrapnel and disperse a glancing hit from a maser beam. The physical layer of armor was a last line of defense after point defense cannons and energy shields. All warships were equipped with energy shields, with battleships having the strongest shield projectors and the densest concentration of those projectors. A small ship, like a destroyer, could only take a few hits before needing to retreat so its shield projectors could recharge, while Valkyrie could absorb hits and stay in the fight. What made Valkyrie a battlecruiser instead of a mere heavy cruiser was its speed and range. Heavy cruisers supported and protected battleships and did not need to be any faster than those slow-moving monsters. A battlecruiser had the armament and protection of a heavy cruiser, with speed equal to or better than a nimble destroyer, plus the ability to travel vast distances without a star carrier. Agile destroyers could fly fast for short distances, then they had to worry about their fuel supply. A battlecruiser did not need to piggyback on a star carrier to travel, although they often did because their escort ships could not fly as far on their own. Anyway, that explained why we had wanted to capture a battlecruiser and why we were able to do that. When we used the bagel slicer, we had to wait for ships traveling alone, and many of those candidates were our desired type of ship. Now you know why we had to wargame multiple scenarios for our attack. If we encountered a squadron of destroyers, we could count on being able to pound those little ships while our shields absorbed hits. If we stumbled upon a heavy cruiser or stronger ship, we had to plan for a quick hit-and-run attack, with the emphasis on the run part. It would be good enough to jump in, disable the star carrier, and escape before the kiddies could get organized and coordinate a response. We did not know exactly what types of ships to expect, because the intel Skippy intercepted did not contain that information. That data had to be available somewhere. It just did not yet reach the relay station we pinged. Did I want better intel before jumping into battle? Yes. Part of learning to lead is accepting that you will throw people into combat without having all the information you want. That's the job. Because you will never have all the information you want, you have to decide how much info is enough. For me, going into our 13th attack, I was overconfident in the intel provided by Skippy. Everything he had told us to that point had been spot on, and I saw no reason this situation should be any different. I didn't see how the situation could be different. Surely the enemy had realized we were somehow reading their messages, and we knew their fleet was frantically replacing Pixies as quickly as possible. We also were pretty damn sure the kiddies had no idea how we were reading their mail, or how much of their message traffic was exposed to us. Skippy had hacked into a system that automatically updated the back-office file storage systems of Max Hulk's relay station AIs, a system so mundane that absolutely no one paid attention to it. The update had bounced from relay station to ships to other stations, propagating across Max Hulk's territory. Within a month, we did not need Pixies to contact relay stations because the AIs had been infected with instructions to trust communications from our ghost ship. We also did not need to fly around pinging multiple relay stations for the info we wanted. Skippy's virus contained search parameters to filter out the data we would find interesting. Whenever a ship passed by, the info we wanted was included in the messages transmitted to the ship and brought to other ships and relay stations. With that set up, we had a nearly perfect view of the enemy's status, movements, and intentions. No way would the Max Hulk suspect how deeply we had penetrated their information security because they didn't imagine such a breach was even possible. Why am I telling you all this? Because I am trying to explain, no, to justify, why I was so overconfident going into that battle. What is that fine print on brochures for investments? Something like, past performance is no indication of future results? Yeah, the Max Hulk should have warned me about that. Rotten kiddies. We had all the advantages, well, we thought we did, before jumping into a battle we didn't really need to fight. We hacked the enemy's communications and had better knowledge of their tactics and the capabilities of their ships than they did. Our ship was larger, faster, and generated more energy for shields and weapons. We had Skippy the Magnificent, while the enemy had AIs who were not trusted to be fully sentient. We knew their position, intentions, and orders, and we could choose when to attack. The enemy had only one advantage. The commander of the attacking ship was a gullible dumbass who took his ship into battle to impress a girl. I mean, hypothetically, that's what happened. All I can say is that commander of the attacking ship is a real jerk. We not only knew where the Max Hulk was scheduled to rendezvous with the pair of light cruisers at an automated refueling station, we also knew the Star Carrier planned to arrive near that star system early to detach the ships it was carrying and rearrange them in a more efficient configuration so they could fit the light cruisers on adjacent docking platforms. What we did not know was exactly when and where the Star Carrier planned to rearrange its sock drawer, and we didn't have a whole lot of time. The best we could do was to jump in near that Red Dwarf Star system and send out micro-wormholes inside missiles. Our unarmed missiles flew outward in a cone-shaped scattershot formation, covering as much area as possible. Would we find the lonely Star Carrier and catch it unaware? Or had it already moved on to the rendezvous point? If we found a single Star Carrier, my plan was to jump in immediately, hit it, and run away. If the carrier had flown to the rendezvous, I had decided to skip the attack. Adding two light cruisers plus other ships that might unexpectedly be refueling was too much risk. I was already having second thoughts about the attack, compounded by Skippy warning me that we had to take one of our railguns offline due to a crack in a magnet assembly. Loss of one railgun was not a significant blow to our combat power. I just felt it was a bad omen. 6 hours later, we had a contact.
Bingo!
Skippy announced, annoying the bridge crew who had seen the same sensor image.
Exactly as I predicted! He was extra smug. One Star Carrier by itself.
No, more data coming in now. It looks like there is one other ship about 600 kilometers from the carrier. They must still be shuffling ships between docking platforms.
We caught them with their pants down, Joe.
No other signs of trouble, I asked warily. A little voice in the back of my head was telling me to back away.
Sims looked up from her console.
There's something funky in the sensor data on the other side of the star carrier. Some kind of gas cloud.
Ah, nothing to worry about, Skippy scoffed. Look, Joe, you brought us all the way out here. Are we jumping in or not? This is just about the best opportunity we'll ever get. With a ship maneuvering close by, the star carrier will have its interference gear switched off. We can jump in as close as we want. I've plotted a jump to bring us in precisely between the two ships. We fire one broadside at each ship and we're out of there before they can get their damping field generators warmed up.
Of course, I wanted more information about the target. The motionless star carrier was so far from our micro wormhole that the sensor data was a bit fuzzy. If we waited for the micro wormhole to get closer, or for us to task more micro wormholes and develop a 3D image of the area, it would be too late. A flood of stupid cliches ran through my stupid brain. Go big or go home. Who dares wins. You'll never know if you don't try. You only live once. Hold my beer, I said to myself, though the sharp look Sims gave me meant I had spoken louder than I intended. All right, let's do this. In my head, what I actually said was, let's get this over with. XO, all stations ready?
Ready in all respects, Colonel, she reported, knowing that data was available to everyone on the main display. Usually I did a Jim Kirk impression. That time I switched it up by doing a Picard, dramatically pointing a finger at the holographic display.
Engage.
Skippy was first to notice something was wrong. While our jump drive was forming its distant endpoint, it sort of slid away from the place Skippy had aimed for. Because Skippy is stubborn, he kept trying to force the endpoint to focus on the correct emergent zone, with the result that by the time he realized that wasn't going to happen, Valkyrie had already been pulled into the wildly twisted space-time of a wormhole. Because Skippy is arrogant, he blamed the jump drive control system, and never considered that he might have been wrong about conditions at the target zone. Because Skippy is incomparably awesome, all of this happened in microseconds, too fast for any monkey to notice a problem or act on it. My own first indication that we had a problem was provided by the main holographic display. What I expected to see was a symbol of Valkyrie in the center, with the nice big fat target of a star carrier on one side and a destroyer on the other. What I actually saw was the star carrier and another ship off to the left, and the entire display glowing hotly orange from a damping field saturating the area. Multiple, overlapping damping fields. Then the big trouble smacked us in the face. Because Skippy had forced us to emerge closer than our jump drive wanted to, our entry was rough, sending waves of chaotic space-time radiating outward like ripples on a pond. That chaos made it temporarily impossible for the star carrier's stealth field to bend photons around it, and we were able to see through the false image. On the docking platforms were not the small warships we expected. There were four heavy cruisers on the racks, and they were detaching as we watched. The star carrier must have blown its docking clamps when we jumped in, performing an emergency separation maneuver. The heavy cruisers were not the only cargo on the racks. There were three patrol cruisers, and I realized the ship flying free was not the destroyer we expected. It was another patrol cruiser. What a wonderful surprise. But wait, things got even better for us. That gas cloud Skippy told us not to worry about? Yeah, that was a second star carrier hidden in a stealth field. The space-time ripples we created also stripped away that ship's concealment. Seeing through the wavering stealth field, our sensors identified four more heavy cruisers and six destroyers. Those ships were already joining the party, tumbling and spinning as they were ejected by their panicked mothership. Eight heavy cruisers, four patrol cruisers, six destroyers, plus two star carriers, which had fired maser and particle cannons, rail guns, and missiles at us before I could speak. Our own weapons, programmed ahead of the jump on the assumption we would emerge where Skippy intended, missed on the first salvo. Our masers and railgun darts went racing off into empty space, and our missiles had to turn and burn to curve back toward their targets. That violent activity made our missiles loud and visible and easy targets for the enemy's point defense systems. Opening my mouth to shout an order, my jaw clamped shut, and I bit my tongue as the ship rocked.
Get us out of here!
No can do, Joe.
Skippy was on the verge of panic. We're caught in
4, 6, hell, lots of damping fields. Plus, I sort of blew the jump drive on the way in. Wherever we're going, we're doing it the long way until I can fix the damned thing. Reed, I barked. Pedal to the metal, sir. Our chief pilot had the ship swinging around to take us away from the battle area. Valkyrie was fast. Masers, railgun darts, and even missiles were faster. Our momentum was taking us toward the second star carrier, and the only good news was that our initial velocity relative to the enemy was 40,000 kilometers per hour. Enemy ships would need to accelerate hard to catch us, even if we weren't accelerating as hard as our big battlecruiser's reactionless thrust engines could push. Have you ever heard the cliche about a person's life flashing before their eyes in a heartbeat? The events of my short life didn't scroll through my brain, but it is amazing how fast a person can think when they need to. In the time it would take to snap my fingers, I took in all the details I needed about the tactical situation, analyzed our options, and decided that the next 60 seconds would determine whether we were screwed or not. My gut was leaning towards screwed, if you want to know. In the Army, I learned about the different types of battles and the tactics appropriate for each situation. What we had prepared for was an ambush. One side, in this case us, uses the advantage of surprise to attack an unprepared enemy. In an ambush, the aggressor can assess the situation and decide whether to attack or not. If we had known the opposition was 2 star carriers and 8 heavy cruisers, I would have ordered us to jump away. The situation we jumped into was not an ambush. It was a meeting engagement. We had not expected to encounter such a strong force, and the enemy hadn't expected us to be there at all. Neither side was prepared for the battle. We sure as hell were not prepared to fight that many heavy ships, plus their escorts. What I saw on the display was that the enemy was also not prepared for a battle right then. One of the heavy cruisers attached to the first star carrier had a reactor shut down, with much of the exterior plating removed. That same ship was missing armor panels and a line along the side facing us. Apparently, they were working on the big railgun that ran along the hull under that armor. The second star carrier had a heavy cruiser that was running on auxiliary power. We knew that because its energy shields were generating only enough power to deflect meteorites. My guess is the Maxalts had planned to trap for us, but not right then or there. In a meeting engagement, neither side expected to fight a battle at that time and location. Either side can choose to disengage rather than conduct a fight they hadn't chosen. That was my hope. The Maxalks must have had the same oh-shit reaction as us and decide to break away from our fearsome ghost ship. If the enemy instead chose to fight, they would pursue while we conducted a fighting withdrawal. Ideally, part of our force would remain as a rear guard to slow the enemy's advance while our main force disengaged and ran away to safety. The enemy would try to drive through or outflank our rear guard, and all that analysis flashed through my mind in the blink of an eye. I didn't need to think about it, because it had been pounded into my head. Training in the United States Army is outstanding. They even made a soldier out of me. The problem with all of my Army training is that it prepared me for fighting as part of a unit, on the ground. Valkyrie was alone, and we didn't have a rear guard. We couldn't take advantage of terrain to create a defensive position, and there was no prepared position nearby that we could run to. If the Maxalks chose to pursue, we had to run until we either couldn't run anymore or until we reached the edge of the enemy damping fields and jumped away. After, of course, Skippy's little helper elf bots fixed our busted jump drive. If they could. The next series of thoughts that raced through my mind was that because we wanted to disengage, we needed to discourage the enemy from pursuing. By turning away from contact and accelerating, we had already shown that we didn't want to fight. That was dangerous for us. It signaled weakness. To discourage the Maxalks from chasing us deep into interstellar space, we had to give them a reason to think twice about sending their heavy ships after us. That meant we needed to demonstrate we could hit them hard. Simp! I started to shout an order to my XO before seeing that the crew was way ahead of me. They all knew the situation as well as I did. They had all reached the same conclusions. Our crew is excellent, and we train until we're exhausted, then we keep training. We train for every scenario, so that when we get into a fight, we just have to repeat the actions we took over and over and over in simulations. From her console, Sims had directed the weapons control teams to focus their second volleys on the 2 vulnerable heavy cruisers.
All she did was point at enemy ships in the 3D holographic display of her console, designating them as targets. In the same gesture, she had reserved our anti-energy pulse cannon for her own control to avoid wasting those shots against unshielded targets. The heavy cruiser running on auxiliary power was a sitting duck for our big guns. Our cannons on the starboard and topside sliced right into it like the proverbial hot knife through a stick of butter. About a third of the way forward from the aft end, that cruiser's hull was peppered with holes and jagged cuts starting at the center and moving outward. Secondary explosions rocked that ship as our particle beams cut through power conduits until a maser blast found the primary target, a missile magazine that was buried in the core of the hull. That ship suddenly was two shattered pieces, with the bow section propelled forward and lurching so that its nose crashed into and buckled that star carrier's long frame. The cannons on Valkyrie's port side and belly engaged a different ship, the heavy cruiser with the missing armor plating. That ship was under power and shielded, so Sims directed our anti-energy pulse cannon to hammer that ship's shields, while railguns launched darts those same shields needed to deflect. At such close range, and under such concentrated fire from our battlecruiser, the target ship soon suffered a collapse of shields in one area. Without needing to be given orders, the weapons teams switched from railguns to directed energy cannons, pouring maser and particle beams into the breach. You might think the first ship was easier prey, because it had been running only on auxiliary power. That made it a sitting duck for our weapons, but it also meant we had limited options for ensuring it blew into 1,000 pieces. The second ship was actually easier to knock out of the fight. As soon as we made a gap in its shields, we hit 2 reactors, and more importantly, the critical jump drive capacitors. When the enemy ship's AI determined that shielding in that area was likely to temporarily be offline, it had commenced draining the stored energy from those capacitors. Too little, too late. Bam! That ship blew like the Death Star. And there wasn't any CGI-created ring like when they remastered the original movie. It just became a ball of intense white light. 3 other heavy cruisers and the patrol cruisers were caught in the expanding blast, but the Star Carrier suffered the worst damage. When the bubble of plasma washed over us so we could see inside it, we saw one patrol cruiser lurching and slowly tumbling, and the Star Carrier was enveloped in its own cloud of superheated plasma vented from its reactors. That first Star Carrier's frame was torn ragged, with bent and shattered structural pieces sticking out at jagged angles, pipes venting gases and fluids, and severed cables flailing around. 2 of the docking pads had broken away to fly off on their own. "Ignore the heavy ships," I gave my first useful order of the battle. "Hit the patrol cruisers first." It was not necessary to tell the crew not to waste weapons fire on the Star Carriers. Those crippled space trucks could launch missiles but were not capable of joining a pursuit. It was necessary to order our weapons directed away from the remaining 6 heavy cruisers, because I saw on the main display they had been outlined as primary targets. Our crew, after knocking 2 major combatants out of the fight, had automatically switched their focus to the ships most capable of hurting us. That was entirely logical. And entirely wrong. What I knew, that the crew hadn't had time to think about, was that we had already done all we could to influence the enemy's decision whether to pursue us or not. Losing 2 major warships in the first 12 seconds of the battle must have been a shock, and that maybe bought us some time. That did not mean the enemy commander would automatically order the remaining ships to turn and fly away from us. The other heavy cruisers were tough targets. They greatly outnumbered us in both hulls and firepower. If Valkyrie got trapped between formations of those heavy ships, we could be in serious trouble. Since we couldn't influence the enemy's decision of whether to pursue us or not, we had to prepare for being pursued. That is why I ordered our fire shifted to the patrol cruisers. Valkyrie could outrun the heavies, so we didn't need to worry about them immediately. The destroyers could also hurt us, but I knew the patrol cruisers were the greatest threat in an extended pursuit. Patrol ships were an unhappy compromise design, intended to operate on their own for long patrols in the far-flung outskirts of Maxulk's territory. They were basically large, stretched destroyer hulls with a few extra missile launchers, more powerful railguns, and higher-capacity fuel tanks. Patrol cruisers were supposed to look for trouble, and if they found it, run away to alert the heavy elements of the fleet. To survive, they relied on the ability to fly fast for long distances. In a pursuit,
that could accelerate harder than Valkyrie and keep burning their engines to match our pace while the slow heavy cruisers fell behind. The enemy would assign the patrol cruisers to harass us and hope to get in a lucky shot at our engines, leaving us drifting helplessly in space while the heavies caught up.
Targeting patrol cruisers, aye.
Sims didn't look at me as her fingers danced in the holographic controls of her console. My next action was simple and didn't require me to dramatically bark orders from the command chair. I prayed. That was all I could do at that moment. There are many prayers used by soldiers before and during battle. You might have heard Psalm 91 referenced. That is a good one, but I've never actually heard anyone use it in the field. The prayers I've heard usually went something like, "Please God, don't let my screw-ups get other people killed." A version of that is what I muttered under my breath quietly, so I didn't distract people who were busily doing something useful. Also, I prayed the enemy commander would make the right decision. Either I hadn't prayed loud enough, or God decided I was on his naughty list. Or maybe the fault was with me for not specifying which right decision I wanted the enemy commander to make. My life sucks.
"Colonel," Sims warned.
"I see it." Good captains keep the emotion from their voice, especially if that emotion is fear. My voice was flatly emotionless, not from an effort of will, but because I was so stunned by nameless terror that I was barely capable of speaking. The enemy was pursuing. All six heavy cruisers were turning to follow us. We had no choice but to fight while we ran, until we either escaped the overwhelming enemy force, or they trapped us and pounded Valkyrie into a disabled hulk. At that point, whoever was in command of the bridge would need to detonate our self-destruct nukes. It was a nightmare. The enemy threw together three formations of ships to harass us, each formation consisting of a patrol cruiser accompanied by a pair of destroyers. The groups of warships took turns running at us, firing weapons and dodging away. Behind us, in relentless pursuit, the heavy cruisers coordinated their railguns to create a shotgun blast effect, so even as Valkyrie turned to dodge the salvos, we couldn't escape all of the darts. Our aft shields were taking a pounding, and the enemy knew it, concentrating their fire on our engineering section. Part of the enemy's targeting of that area was a deliberate decision, and part of it was forced, because they were behind us. We went into the fight with an initial velocity advantage of 11 kilometers per second, or 40,000 kilometers per hour. At 11 kps, we could cross the state of Texas from east to west in 2 minutes. On Earth, that sounds like a huge number. In space combat, it is nothing. Every second, we crawled only 11 clicks farther from the maser cannons that could shoot focused beams of high-energy photons at the speed of light. 4 minutes after we jumped in, the enemy had gotten their shit together and were accelerating hard after us, while Valkyrie's mighty engines pushed us as hard as they could. It wasn't enough. On the main display was a variety of information I could select from a menu. One number I focused on was relative velocity. It was down below 10 kilometers per second. Our overall speed was increasing. The enemy was catching us.
"Reed," I demanded. "Why aren't we moving like a bat out of hell?"
"It's not her fault, Joe," Skippy answered. "We've got several problems working against us. The jump not only blew that drive, it ruptured power connections in the aft end of the ship. I've got bots working to feed more juice to the engines, but they can't work on the power conduits while they're hot, so I'm shutting down the feeds one by one, which makes us even slower."
"How long to restore full power?"
"I honestly don't know yet, Joe. The bots haven't finished assessing the damage. That's another problem. We've already lost 3 bots to overflash damage from railgun impacts. The shields are blocking the darts, but, you know, some of that kinetic energy is converted into heat that bleeds through the hull. We're taking a lot of hits, and the energy generators are dumping excess energy overboard. My bots are getting caught in the crossfire. Even the ones that don't get hit can't work as efficiently. The heat and vibration are also reducing